I'm back. This is Seth with 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, picking up from where we left off last year. And exactly where did we leave off last year? Well, we left off in Toby Cresswell's incredible palette of 1001 Songs with the Beastie Boys and Hey Ladies. If you can think back to that time so long ago, in fact, it might have just been last week if you've been listening to the repeats, but at any rate, after that particular song, we're going to start the new season with Bob Dylan and All Along the Watchtower. Now, Toby Cresswell said when he was writing this book that it's not about the greatest songs of all time. He's being a bit far too namby-pamby to say this is number one and this is number two and this is number three. He just wants to get 1001 songs which he thinks will broaden your palate. And his personal experience as a music journalist, he's, well, I suppose he's entitled to his opinion. Anyway, this is Bob Dylan and All Along the Watchtower. At a time when the Beatles were at their most baroque and the world was going psychedelic with opportunities offered by new recording studios, Bob Dylan recorded his album John Wesley Harding, accompanied only by a bass player and a drummer with a pedal steel on two of the other tracks. It was a complete about-face. For some months, Dylan had been recording demo tapes with Hawks. Over 100 songs had been written. Dylan went to Nashville, however, to cut his new album and used none of them. John Wesley Harding is full of ancient images from the Wild West and the Bible. The characters in these songs deal with eternal truths in oblique ways. All Along the Watchtower is an apocalyptic song set in a mythical landscape of castles and horsemen and strange portents. It's a song with images that don't lead themselves into literal reading. The vampiric businessman probably refers to the manager, Albert Grossman, who Dylan felt was exploiting him. The sense of paranoia probably comes from the hordes of hippies who besieged Dylan's property at this time. There was a sense in that this generation of freaks and hippies and dropouts was leading somewhere at their most prescient commentators such as Joe Didion, I think that's how you say it, D-I-D-I-O-N, had started to speculate about the dark side of the social anarchy of the 1960s. Despite its oblique imagery, All Along the Watchtower was a song that spoke to its time. The song's biggest fan was guitarist Jimi Hendrix, who, upon hearing it, booked a studio with his band The Experiments and guitarist Dave Mason and cut a version on the spot. Hendrix arranged the tune and added his own tempestuous guitar line, swirling around like the gathering storm. Hendrix had a major hit with the song. Dylan, too, preferred the cover version over the original. When playing live, he uses the Hendrix arrangement rather than his own. That's interesting, and it's funny, because Toby Cresswell didn't actually put the Hendrix version in here, he put the Dylan version. But there you go. I suppose he's entitled to his opinion once again. And here's Bob Dylan and All Along the Watchtower.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. Reason to get excited, the thief he kindly spoke. There are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now, the hour is getting late. All along the watchtower, princes kept the view. while all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching, the wind began to howl.
And that was Bob Dylan and All Along the Watchtower. You're with Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM. And this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, selected by Toby Cresswell and presented by Seth Titley-Jones. I can still remember how to say all that. I'm quite impressed with myself. But, well, what was it I was about to tell you? Because, oh no, I've had a blank. I can't remember the next bit. Oh, yes, the next bit is the bit where I tell you what song is coming next. The song that is coming next is Lithium by Nirvana. Kurt Cobain was the leader, not of the Alternative Nation, but of the Ritalin generation. The singer had a troubled childhood, growing up poor in a fractured family. When I was 7, he told John Savage, I had a really good childhood, then all of a sudden my whole world changed. I remember feeling ashamed. I became antisocial and I started to understand the reality of my surroundings, which didn't have a lot to offer. It's such a small town that I couldn't find any friends who were compatible. I like doing artistic things. I like to listen to music. I could never find friends like that. I always felt so different and so crazy, and people just left me alone, and they were afraid. I always felt that they would vote me most likely to kill everyone at high school dance. I could definitely see how a person's mental state could deteriorate to the point where they could do that. I've got to the point where I've fantasized about it, but I've always opted for killing myself first. Cobain's family suffered through the great changes that happened in society in the 60s and 70s with prescription drugs and blurred notions of family. These kids were the victims of massive social change. Cobain clearly went through the eye of the storm, medicated with Ritalin and other drugs. From both the pharmacy and the street corner, he was a junkie primed to happen. Lithium reflects the intense emotional confusion that was Cobain's short life. The phrases, I love you, I missed you, I killed you, contrasted with the cry, I'm not gonna crack. On this last track, you can hear on this track... I don't know where I got the word last from. It's just because I suppose when you read bits of music or things about music, like on the back of CDs or on the internet or in magazines and things, they often say last track. I don't know why, but I suppose when they happen to be referring to the last track, then they'll say that, and I just imagine that this said last in it. But it says, on this track, you can hear Cobain holding it all inside, and in hindsight, that last cry was actually bravado. Lithium by Nirvana.
I'm so happy, 'cause today I found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly, that's okay, so are you. Look, I'm his Sunday mornings, every day for all I care. I'm not scared by my candles in our days, 'cause I found God. Cause today I shave my head. I'm not sad, I'm just maybe I'm to blame for all I've heard. I'm not sure, I'm so excited, I can't wait to meet you there. I don't care, I'm so horny, that's okay. Yeah!
1001 songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell and presented by Seth Tetley-Jones. That was... we've just ticked over the 200 mark, actually, and that was Nirvana and Lithium. I meant the other way around. Lithium and Nirvana. In fact, no, Nirvana and Lithium. See if you can make sense of that. The next song is MC5 and Shakin' Street from 1970, and it appears on the album Back in the USA. The MC5's debut album was neither revolutionary or commercial enough. The label Elektra dropped the group, and MC5 began to distance themselves from the White Panther Party. I don't know if you recall before, but there was another MC5 track, I believe it was Kick Out the Jams, that we had sometime last year, and that Toby Cresswell mentions their affiliation with the White Panther Party in the United States. They signed with Atlantic Records and hired rock critic John Landau to helm the recording for the next album. Landau would soon become manager and producer of Bruce Springsteen and other Platinum Records. However, MC5 sessions were his first. Landau thought that the MC5's high energy needed to be contained and cleaned up. He had no time for the revolutionary politics, but wanted to bring out the group's musical qualities. "We all met up with John Landau, and he was good for us in a couple of ways," said guitarist Wayne Kramer. He was trying to stress discipline, trying to get us back to where we were about a year and a half before we made our first record. Just being a solid, tight, aggressive rock and roll band. He tried to clean us up, but he went overboard with it. He wasn't the right producer to be doing the MC5 second record. If the sessions for the second album didn't have the fury and the capacious crunch of the live album, the songwriting had come along. Shakin' Street was written by guitarist Fred Sonic Smith, a wonderful pop song based on the insistent tempo of hard-strummed acoustic guitars embellished by a motivating electric guitar riff. Despite complaints about the production, Shakin' Street is a great pop song that established a sound that would be mimicked at the end of the decade by groups such as Flamin' Groovies and the Dictators and their followers in the American New Wave. Smith's vocal also listed the track. While not a strong singer, he had more control and character than Rob Tyner usually warbled for the MC5. We really wanted to prove that we're a great rock and roll band, said Kramer of the second album. And you know, when you're young and you've put your first album out and you've opened your heart and soul for the whole world to see, and you get criticized the way you get criticized... Look... This is quite interesting. You see, he's gone, and you get criticized the way he's get criticized. The first time he's spelt criticized with a Z, and the second time he's spelt it with an S at the end, you know, ZED or SED. I think I've spotted something there. And they came down on us with a sledgehammer. Not only were we too revolutionary for the straight world, we weren't revolutionary enough for the revolutionary world. So we got it from both sides. That we could handle. That we could handle, but when we were criticized for our musicianship, that really hurt us. And that got us where we lived and damaged our little egos. We really wanted to prove ourselves because we knew that we could play and that we were a great rock and roll band. So the second album was designed to win over all those people that said that they were revolutionary hype or that we couldn't tune our guitars. The funny thing is that we put an album of 2.5 minute, highly focused content, heavy political rock songs in a day, and they're featuring 15-minute guitar solos. And this is MC5 and Shaking Street.
Taking and the shake for the shaking. Ha!
MC5 and Shaking Street here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, the secrets are behind them. I still can't do that. I did once manage to do that very, very fast, but evidently I'm a little out of practice. This is 1001 Songs, and I'm Seth Tetley-Jones. And next we have Jeff Buckley, and Last Goodbye. Ethereable. I think I'll start that again. Ethereal, not ethereable, thank you. Ethereal entanglable. I've got that one wrong as well. I really must read these more closely. We'll start for the fifth time. Ethereal, intangible, otherworldly. These are the kinds of words brought to mind by Jeff Buckley's short career. Buckley seemed fragile, abandoned by his rock star father. He was a songwriter with a tremulous voice, a beautiful face, and a clear picture of the dark side of life. Buckley also was out of sync with the times. His songs didn't fit into alternative rock, which was the prevailing style of 1994. Buckley's music was literate, understanding jazz and blues and ethnic styles as well as rock. Last Goodbye was as close to conventional to a conventional pop song as Buckley would write. In it, he absorbs influences from Pakistan to Memphis and turns them into something resembling rock music. The sessions for Grace, which is the album that Last Goodbye is from, took place in Bearsville outside New York with the producer Andy Wallace. I think I've heard his name before somewhere in this book. Now, see if you can remember it, because I'm not going to be thumbing through here spending my entire life finding that one specific reference to Andy Wallace, but I know it's in here somewhere. So rack your brains, ladies and gentlemen, because you may just be pleasantly surprised, or not so pleasantly surprised, or neutrally surprised, depending on your particular frame of mind at the moment, as to what you can remember with regards to the producer, Andy Wallace, if you have a very good memory. Better than mine, which has its occasional lapses. Anyway, Andy Wallace, who mixed Nirvana's Nevermind, was therefore... Oh, that's why we've heard it, because he mixed Nirvana's Nevermind. But Andy Wallace mixed Nirvana's Nevermind, and therefore the Jeff Buckley Grace album was hot, because it was produced by Andy Wallace. Buckley had made a name for himself as a singer-songwriter playing small clubs in New York, and it was expected that the debut album would reflect that. However, over the 5 weeks spent at Bearsville, the chemistry in the group, guitarist Michael Teich, bass player Mike Grondahl, and drummer Matt Johnson, brought these songs to new and better lives. Last Goodbye means a lot to me because it's the time that I wrote it. A long time ago, I was around in an environment that thought that my songs were completely loser songs, Buckley told me in 1996. Not me personally, Toby Creswell. I bet he just had this moment where there was this glint in his eye as he'd write that, Buckley told me. Yes, this famous person has been talking to me because I'm the editor of the Rolling Stone. Actually, I better mention that in the little blurb about the author at the back. In fact, I'm too busy to do that. I'll ring up my publisher and ask her to do that instead. Yes. And meanwhile, Seth is going to keep reading this back over in little old New Zealand. I put them on a label to prove that at least the songs that they weren't losers. They were worth recording. Sort of like finding kids that have been told all their lives they're pieces of shit and finally have to go around proving to them by putting them in a completely other setting that they're not. They're worth knowing and loving. Last Goodbye covers that sense of loss that stalks so much of Buckley's world. So many of his inspirations, Edith Piaf, Miles Davis, Judy Garland, and Nina Simone, were artists who had trouble living. Buckley's music is haunted by them. The muscular guitar and bass riffs that drive the song play off against the rugger-like second guitar and the spectral atmosphere of the tune. Some people are just born into bodies, born into lifespans that don't fit anywhere else, and they have little to hang on to and to validate, and also it's a very lonely thing to notice a certain sense of life and be able to relate that to anyone, he told me. It's probably the onset of madness, or it must seem so to the person who sees the world in a certain way. Maybe they see spirits everywhere, or maybe they divine information from certain happenings and certain peoples that are invisible to most of us, and as a result, people deem those experiences as not valid and not important and crazy too, and that can damage a person. There's a lot of strength to the self-destructive soul. Is there another page? No, there's not. So here's Jeff Buckley and Last Goodbye.
I hate to feel the love between us now, but it's over. Just hear this and then I'll go. Well, you gave me more than ever, more than you'll ever know. This is our last of words.
because I didn't know you at all.
Jeff Buckley and Last Goodbye, right here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4. And next we have another Dylan song. We have Most of the Time. Dylan brought... What have we got? What does it say here? Bob Dylan thought Bob Dylan was pretty much finished in 1989. It says Bob Dylan twice, and so it's kind of hard to read. He was even knocked back from joining the Grateful Dead. As at the suggestion of Bono from U2, Dylan teamed up with producer Daniel Lanois and quickly cut an album in his Kingsway Studios at New Orleans. Lanois was a hard taskmaster for Dylan, who was often uncomfortable working in studios. Indeed, he hadn't made a record that sounded any good for 15 years. Lanois gave Dylan a new sound. Most of the Time is a song about time, and probably where there is most of it, but Toby Creswell just says that it's a song about time. It's about recalling a lover from the past and carrying that memory. It's, in a sense, a rewrite from Girl from the North Country. What distinguished the song, however, was the beautiful bass guitar figure that booms through the canyons of loneliness. Then there's Dylan's voice, which plays with the idea of a man in denial about his own regret. This is Bob Dylan and Most of the Time.
Most of the time focused all around. Most of the time I can keep both feet on the ground. I can follow the path, I can read the sign, stay right with it when the road unwinds. I can handle whatever I stumble upon. I don't even notice. See you gone. most of the time. Most of the time, it's well understood. Most of the time, I wouldn't change it if I could. I can make it all match up. I can hold my own. I can deal with the situation right down to the bone. I can survive and I can endure. And I don't even think about her most of the time. Most of the time, my head is on straight. Most of the time, I'm strong enough not to hate. I don't build up illusion till it makes me sick. I ain't afraid of confusion, no matter how thick. I can smile in the face of mankind. Don't even remember what her lips felt like on mine. Most of the time. Most of the time, she ain't even in my mind. Know if I saw her, she's that far behind. Most of the time, I can't even be sure if she was ever with me or if I was ever with her. Most of the time, I'm halfway content. Most of the time, exactly where it all went. I don't cheat on myself, I don't run and hide from the feelings that I buried inside. I don't compromise and I don't pretend. I don't even care if I ever see her again. Most of the time,
Most of the Time by Bob Dylan, right here on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM, and also live streaming, if anybody out there is listening on live streaming on the internet, a flash news service that's very, very new and very, very exciting, and not many people have heard of it before, and... no, it doesn't really work, does it? The whole internet being a novelty thing, it's been kind of been done. I mean, I think it had its last with Flight of the Conchords when Murray Hewitt says, yes, on the internet service, yes, you could never do a scam on that, you know, because, I mean, it's one of the trusted things of today's society. But what do I know? Anyway, you can listen to us live streaming on www.waihikiradio.org.nz. You can also listen to us on the actual radio on 88.3 or 107.4 FM. this particular show that you're listening to right now is called 1001 Songs, and it is presented by somebody who's me, who's called Seth Tetley Jones, and written, well, it's not written, but it sort of has the songs that have little blurbs written about them by Toby Cresswell, who's this Australian journalist who I've never met and hope never to, because I'm, you know, my opinion of him changes constantly as I have to bathe in his writing and inflict his writing upon you. And the next example of his writing that I have is his musings upon Teardrop by Massive Attack. The latest in a long line of sublime singers, the Cocteau Twins vocalist Elizabeth Fraser has contributed four tracks to Massive Attack's album Mezzanine and gave them their first hit single with Teardrop. Fraser's voice itself was epic. Here it slowly unfolds against the dreamy Massive Attack tunes. One critic said of the song, "Hearing it for the first time is like holding a fine piece of filigree glasswork on the tip of your tongue and then recklessly biting into it only to find out that it's actually made of sugar." Massive Attack made the record as the trio was splitting apart. Their debut album, Blue Lines, from 1991, was one of the defining moments of popular music. Deep bass and soul grooves meant reggae and hip-hop. There was pressure on the group to keep pushing boundaries that led to dissent. The problems within the group are nothing to do with the cultural differences. They're to do with the fact that we don't necessarily get on as people, said Daddy G, a.k.a. Grantley Marshall. Things are never really disposed of, said Grantley Marshall, because you're at such close quarters all the time. The same stuff crops up over and over again, and you think, shouldn't we have got that out in the open a long time ago? Usual. It's a very generic way of talking about relationship issues there, but that is his words. The tension amongst the parties led to a tension in the music over which Fraser's voice could skate. And that is, what's her name? Elizabeth Fraser from the Cocteau Twins. She's very, very quite excitable and quite mad in the best way, said Grantley Marshall. She threw a million words into the air, and we tried to grab a few and work out what she meant. Me and Mush met her in Sainsbury's and invited her up to the studio. There was this nerve-wracking moment before she arrived, and I said, it's really sterile in here. Let's light some candles in here and make it funky for her. She loved our Susie and the Banshees sample off Metal Postcard. She'd just had the Susie and the Banshees tattoo removed from her arm. We didn't use the track, but she's really cool. Her voice is so immense and ethereal. And this is Massive Attack and a Teardrop. I thought I'd just sing the next note. Because I've always wondered on that track, why don't they just put that note in there? I mean, every other time it goes dum, dum, like that. I mean, if they really wanted to do it properly, what they would have done is they would have gone dum, dum, dum. Like that, you see? See, that would have been very clever, and but it wouldn't have quite been... Well, I suppose they just decided that they'd leave it out. You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4, www.waihekeradio.org.nz, 1001 Songs, Toby Creswell, Seth Tetley-Jones. I think that's enough keywords for you in there. This is TLC and Waterfalls. In their short, volatile career, TLC made some of the best R&B of the 90s, starting out pretty much as rough with raps and attitude, but by the time they made Crazy Sexy Cool, they had incorporated Prince's erotic moves, L.A. Reid, and Babyface's no-nonsense New Jack production, and their own street smarts. They made tabloids with fights with lovers and hard partying. In the meantime, they sold a lot of records. What I really loved about TLC when I first met them was that they had a really definite opinion of what kind of group they wanted to be, said L.A. Reid. TLC won't sing hit songs that don't represent their points of view. I don't care who wrote it or how big a hit it could be. The group started as part of an organized noise is part of organized noise in Atlanta, where the hip-hop scene thrived around writer-producers such as Dallas Austin, Boys to Men, Rico Wade, who co-wrote Waterfalls. Lisa Left Eye Lopez tended to supply the attitude, while Tione Watkins and Rajonda Thomas brought the vocals, which were both sexy and inviting while also being strong and conscious. TLC might go out with you, but they weren't going to leave the attitude behind. TLC were emancipated women, and modern women responded. Waterfalls was TLC at their most princely and seductive. See, we came pretty much as it is. We knew what we were going to do and sing and dress and everything, and all you had to do was the paperwork. TLC and Waterfalls.
Takes a glimpse in the mirror, but he doesn't Yesterday, but too many storms have come and gone, leaving a trace. I'm not one God to give a praise. It because my life is in shades of gray. I pray all sin fade away, sell the praise and for the 70s. And like his promise is true, only my faith can undo the many chances I believe would bring my life to a new, clear blue and unconditional. Skies have dried the tears from my eyes, no one lonely cries. My only leading hope is for the folk who can't cope with such an enduring pain that it keeps them in the pouring rain. Who's to blame for tuning in into your own vein? What a shame you're shooting aim for someone else's brain. You claim the insane and aim to stay in time for falling right to crime. I say the system got you victim to your own mind. Dreams are hopeless aspirations and hopes are coming true. Believe in yourself, the rest is up to me. Yeah.
Don't go chasing waterfalls.
TLC and Waterfalls here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, selected by Toby Creswell and presented by Teth... Oh. I almost got it right that time! Almost! Alright? Now, it's coming up to the end of the show now, and we've got Devo and Whippet from 1980. 2 years after they first appeared with their Convergal Joko Homo 45, the flip side was Mongoloid. Controversial. I thought I missed out a T in there. Then their stripped-down version of the Stone Satisfaction, Devo were no longer weirdo outsiders in the rock and roll world. They were spearheading the new wave with their doctrine of devolution. Devolution was a combination of Wonder Woman comic book and the movie Island of Lost Souls, the original, with Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and Charles Laughton, said Castle. And you can see up at the top there, the writing credits, it says Gerald V. Casale, I think it is, and Mark Mothersbaugh. Anyway, this is Casale, or whatever his name is. That was various things that I'd been thinking about. Devolution, of going ahead to go back. Things falling apart. Entropy. It grabbed every piece of information and gave it to some kind of cohesive presence. It was a package, just as our music and our identity exist as technique rather than style. They were lauded by David Bowie and Neil Young. They were cute and funny and kind of slick. They were one of the first groups to make complete use of drum machines and rock as rock instruments in their own right. On Whippet, the ascending and descending runs of the song in a slightly obscure time signature with the heavy emphasis on the synthesizer made the song both familiar and novel at the same time. The tortured tunes of early Devo gave way to the dense synthesizer sound over the robotic automated beats. The sound fitted with the group's belief that society was becoming increasingly contrived and standardized. Ironically, this attack on mass consumerism was embraced by the masses, and Devo became major rock stars. Whippet works on a number of levels. There are the S&M connotations, of course, and the fact that the video was shot in the style of a low-budget porn movie. The lyric is also clearly a satire of the self-help jargon and the new age-ish affirmations that were starting to creep up into the regular discourse. It's unlikely, however, that much of the satiric content was registered by the million Americans who bought the track and the album Freedom of Choice. Devo, said Jerry Casale in 1978. I almost said 1798. That would have... that wouldn't be quite accurate. Is just the enema bag, the clean-up squad. We're getting the broom out to make way for the 80s. And they did. And so here for you is Devo and Whip It. Devo and Whip It. This was 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. Selected by Toby Cresswell and presented by Seth Tetley-Jones. I will be back next Monday at 8 p.m. And my show, this particular show in question here, will be repeated on Saturday at 2 p.m. Yes. All that and more. I'm getting to sound more commercial every minute here. All that and more. You hear the little dot, dot, dot between the all that and more, because that's important, right? Are here on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 FM and 107.4 FM. And also live streaming on www.waihekeradio.org.nz.